afternoon session, and I will ask Megan to call the next case.
The court will now call Ventura Beach State, Mr. Franklin Wilkinson to argue for appellant, and Ms. Sharon Johnson to argue for the state.
Mr. Mickelson?
Matt Brooks?
Yes, please.
May it please the court, my name is Mr. Mickelson, and I represent Tony Danko. First, I'd like to clarify for the court that I think my first argument, which was a factual sufficiency argument, is foreclosed by the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals decision in Brooke versus State. I am going to focus on the second argument, which is essentially an argument that relies on the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals' rather venerable decision in McClure versus State. Okay.
So is it your position that you're waiving your first point, or is it your position that we need to address it under the new Brooks standard, or what exactly is your position on your first point?
I think you would fairly have to address it, but say that now I raised the argument as a factual sufficiency argument,
right,
not as a legal sufficiency argument. Now under Brooks versus State, the court is to only apply a legal sufficiency standard of review.
So you would like us to treat your first point as raising Brooks' legal sufficiency standard of review?
In fairness, I raised it as a factual sufficiency argument. I didn't argue that if all the evidence was considered in the light most favorable to the state. There were two separate levels of review. I don't think, in candor to the court, that we could reach the legal sufficiency standard. That's why it was raised. I know traditionally defense lawyers raise it both as legal standard and as factually sufficient. They do both. Sometimes, as in this case, where I was troubled by the strength of the evidence, I raise it purely as a factual sufficiency issue.
Okay, so what are you requesting us to do on your first point at this point in time?
I think the issue is foreclosed by Brooke versus State. I mean, I don't know that's properly a waiver of the argument, but I raise it as a factual sufficiency standard.
So you're not requesting that we address your first point?
No.
Okay.
I think it's foreclosed by Brooke versus State.
Okay. Thank you.
So the issue that I do think I do want to discuss, and that I do think is troubling in this case, is the state's argument. In McClure versus State, the facts in that case were essentially very similar to this case. They were maybe slightly more egregious, but the state emphatically attempted in the guilt and innocence phase to inform the jury that the lesser included offense carried a lesser punishment. In McClure versus State, as in this case, the objection was sustained. And the state nevertheless went ahead and informed the jury of the punishment range in that case. Now, in fairness, the first statement made by the state in this case was a reference to the fact that the lesser included offense was a misdemeanor. And alert defense counsel at trial objected at that point. Now, that's not flagrantly informing the maximum is 1 year. You would have to assume that the jury, or at least some jurors, may very well have been informed of the fact that the lesser included offense now carried a lesser punishment. And I think, and I will even say in fairness, I think that lapse, if that was the only lapse, could be forgiven. What really troubled me is once the objection was sustained, that in rebuttal, it was not only mentioned again, but it was mentioned and it was made clear that that is not as bad as the charged offense that we are encouraging you to convict the defendant for. Now, to tell the jury that's not as bad to me seems to be a blatant attempt to inform the jury that that to consider the punishment issue and to be aware of the fact that the lesser included offense carried less harsh penalties. And that is clearly against the rules. There's no, not the state in this case, no opinions say that it is permissible in the guilt and innocence phase for the state to argue punishment to the jury in consideration of whether or not to convict under the lesser included offense. And I read in the state's argument, somewhat surprisingly, the assertion is made that there wasn't an attempt to, after an admonishment, to continue to argue or inform the jury that the lesser included offense carried lesser punishment, and there clearly was. I don't understand how that can be stated. The state cited an unpublished opinion and another opinion. I don't think either of those cases are on point. I think there are cases where the state has simply informed the jury that it's a misdemeanor, and that has been overlooked. Okay, that has basically been found by the different courts to be distinguishable or not to arise to the level of that in McClure versus State. But I don't understand. This wasn't simply an assertion that it was a punishment. It wasn't simply an assertion. One of the cases the state cites, there was simply a statement that there's aggravated assault, there's assault, there's deadly conduct, and the court said that's okay. It's fine to articulate the various offenses. That again is clearly distinguishable from first saying it's a misdemeanor, and then in rebuttal saying that's not as bad as the offense that we want you to convict the defendant for. I think that's outside the rules, and in this case, it was the only issue in the case. There was no question that Tony Danko was going to be convicted of something. I mean, the argument of the defense was this was a reckless conduct case and not an aggravated assault against a police officer case. And those facts were reasonable. There are two stories and two ways to understand these facts. One is that Tony Danko, intoxicated, police coming in through the door as to try to render aid, saw the police, and for some reasons no motive has ever been ascribed to him, perhaps we could speculate death by police officer or something, raised his gun intentionally at them in order to threaten them. The other, very plausible, is that Mr. Danko raised the gun to drop the gun, as if he was doing this, raised it up and dropped the gun, his movements were confused by the fact that he was intoxicated. There was evidence that he was moving unusually slowly and did appear intoxicated at a glance. So those were the two narratives, and the state made it clear to the jury that you need to consider the fact that deadly conduct is not as bad as the offense of aggravated assault on a police officer. And I think that was clearly improper. Briefly, I think the court should go ahead and resolve the question of whether the participant or the victim in a threat case has to perceive the threat. I don't think it is true that the missing officer, the officer did not testify, did say drop the gun, but it's not clear that he saw the gun raised. We don't know. We don't have his testimony. I think that is an interesting question of law that the Court of Criminal Appeals left open. There was even a dissent in that case saying we should go ahead and decide this. I think that question should be decided in order to clarify Texas law. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
May it please the court, my name is Sharon Johnson. I'm here for the state. Since Mr. Mickelson spent most of his time on the state's argument, I suppose I will do the same. And I don't think he disagrees with me, but I do think it bears repeating. The mere mention that something is an offense, that doesn't mean it's an improper argument. Is a misdemeanor, doesn't mean it's an improper argument or a harmful argument. The forbidden argument is urging a jury to convict based on the punishment range. The jury's not to consider punishment at the guilt phase of trial when they're making their deliberations. And the improper thing is to urge a jury to find someone guilty of a greater offense so they have a greater punishment range available to punish the defendant. The argument Mr. Mickelson focused on most, that of the prosecutor in rebuttal, the second prosecutor to speak, his exact words were, deadly conduct sounds bad, but it's not nearly as bad as aggravated assault. And when you view the argument in context, he is not talking about punishment range here. He never mentions punishment range or refers to that impermissible reason for a jury to convict. Deadly conduct sounds bad. The word deadly sounds bad. It sounds worse than aggravated assault. And that's what he's telling this jury. That sounds bad. But aggravated assault is worse. The conduct that is punishable under the aggravated assault statute is more serious. It's more dangerous. It's worse than the conduct that is punishable under the deadly conduct statute. Before he made that remark, the statement immediately preceding was, Lieutenant Keller sums up what was going through the minds of those seven people out there, and that will tell you why this isn't just deadly conduct. He referred to the testimony in the case. He was referring to the fact that these officers felt that this defendant might be about to shoot and kill them, and that is what he's telling this jury. That behavior, that pointing the gun at the officers, threatening the officers' lives, that is aggravated assault. That's worse than just recklessly threatening someone. Intentionally threatening someone is much worse than recklessly threatening someone. So I think all the prosecutor in this case was doing was pointing out to the jury, first of all, don't let that word deadly kind of throw you off because it sounds worse than aggravated assault. But second of all, deadly conduct's not as bad, and the facts of this case show that what this defendant was constituted aggravated assault. One of the cases that I cited in my brief, but I didn't actually mention what the exact words of the argument were, was Arrington. It's an El Paso case. And in that case, the prosecutor argued he wants you to convict on a misdemeanor assault. This level of violence is not a misdemeanor assault. And the court found that the argument was couched in terms of arguing the facts as opposed to the punishment ranges and was proper. I submit this is a similar sort of argument. By definition, the lesser offense is not going to be as egregious and as serious as the greater offense. Again, I'm sort of beating a dead horse, but that's what this prosecutor was telling a jury. Both prosecutors in their argument referred the jurors to the law in the court's charge. They referred the jurors to the evidence before them. That is the only basis they ever urged the jury to convict on, to look at the evidence, look at the law, put the two together, and you'll see he's guilty of the greater offense here. I didn't really address the issue of harm in my brief, and I thought I might do that just slightly. Of course, the first thing that the court looks at in determining harm from an improper argument is the prejudicial effect of that argument. And I would point out that, you know, this jury knew, well, if this jury was looking for the offense that had the harshest punishment, and they wanted to convict so that they could give a harsh punishment, that's not what happened here. This defendant was given 5 years on his first count, which was the minimum. The punishment range was 5 to 99 or life. On the second two counts, he got 10 years, and the jury recommended community supervision on both of those. So this wasn't a jury that was being influenced by some argument that, yes, find him guilty of the greater so you can give him 30 or 40 or 50 years, the greater punishment. They actually gave him a very minimal punishment, especially based on the facts of this case. As far as curative measures, the judge did instruct the jury to disregard the first prosecutor's reference to the offense as a misdemeanor, although she overruled the objections to the other two arguments. And as far as certainty of conviction, I refer the court to the first point of error, the sufficiency of the evidence to show intent, and I think that's pretty strong. These firemen and officers in uniforms and marked vehicles out there with the lights flashing on their vehicles out there for half an hour pounding on the door and saying police, and then when the door actually opens, the lights on the porch are on, they're visible as police, and they tell this defendant to drop the gun and hit the ground, and instead he raises and points it directly at them. And I'm sorry, I can't recall exactly which witness it was. I think it was Lieutenant Keller who testified he could actually see the defendant's finger on the trigger when he had the gun pointed directly at him. So I think the certainty of conviction of aggravated assault was pretty good based on these facts. As for the third issue, that of whether a victim has to perceive the threat in order for there to be an aggravated assault, I think it's pretty clear from Olivas that they do not. And if the court wants to reach that issue, that's, you know, certainly you're right. I don't think on the facts of this case you have to, because I think Officer Riggle's testimony that he could hear Officer Arguella yelling, drop the gun, means he did perceive the threat. He did realize this man had a gun and was a threat to them. And, you know, Judge Keller says it in that little one-paragraph concurrence on Olivas, that the court has laid the groundwork and gone right up to this, taking the step of finding that the injured party doesn't have to perceive the threat, but just didn't quite go there, and she didn't see any reason why they shouldn't. So I would urge that if the court is going to resolve the issue, it should be resolved in favor of the proposition that the victim doesn't have to perceive the threat. All that being said, I would just ask that the court affirm the conviction, and thank you for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Counsel rebuttal.
Thank you. I just urge the court to compare the facts in these cases carefully to those in McClure. In McClure, it was almost the same language. After the prosecutor first discussed the fact that the lesser included offense carried a lesser punishment, and an objection was sustained, the prosecutor then later asserted that you get less, which to my mind sounds a lot like it's not as bad as. There was another objection, and then the prosecutor again said you get, it carries less harsh of a punishment than the greater included offense. So, you know, I think it's pretty clear what the prosecutor was trying to do in this case, and then I'm particularly troubled by it in light of a sustained objection previously. I cannot make any sense out of the fact that when the prosecutor actually made the more egregious statement, said it's not as bad as aggravated assault, that the court overruled the defense objection. It's clear that the jury could have felt free to consider that. In terms of the punishment and the speculation and harm, there's no way to know. I mean, the jury may very well have thought this deserves more than 1 year, and so we're not going to go with a misdemeanor offense that is less bad than an aggravated assault offense. So they convicted him and sentenced him 5 years. I don't think that argument really is logical. Thank you.
Thank you, Jonathan. Thank you both for your good arguments and your briefs, and your case is submitted, and you're excused.